Well, hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Leslie Kernison, board-certified geriatrician and founder of the website BetterHealthWhileAging.net. And this is the Better Health While Aging video podcast, where we discuss common health problems that affect people over the age of 60 and the best ways to prevent and manage those problems. In today's episode, I'm going to review the basics of another very common chronic condition that affects older adults, and that is prediabetes and diabetes, specifically type 2 diabetes. Since this is such a common condition, I'm going to do a little series of episodes on it, actually, so that if you have this condition, or you might have it, or if you're caring for someone who has it, you can understand this condition better. And specifically, in this episode, I'm really going to focus on the basics of diabetes, including what it means to have normal blood sugar versus prediabetes versus diabetes. And then in an upcoming episode, I'll go into more details about how we usually treat diabetes in older adults, including medication options. So specifically in this video, I'll be covering the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes. What is the definition of prediabetes and diabetes? Signs and symptoms of high blood sugar. How diabetes is diagnosed. What the goal blood sugar should be in aging adults, because we do take a little bit of a different approach to that in geriatrics than the endocrinologists sometimes do. How diabetes is treated. How one might treat prediabetes. And then what to do if you're concerned about blood sugar. So we're going to get started with that. But before I do, I have a very quick request, which is if you are here and you find this topic interesting, or if you've been finding my video podcast interesting, if you haven't subscribed yet, if you could please go ahead and subscribe, it would really mean a lot to me. It does help me out. It helps other people find the channel when you subscribe, and it does help the work I'm doing at Better Health While Aging. Okay, let's get back to diabetes now. So before I tell you about type 1 versus type 2 diabetes, I want to just start by helping you understand the relationship between blood glucose and diabetes. So glucose, which is a fancy word for sugar, really, it's a molecule and it's the main source of energy for the body's cells. We get it primarily by eating carbohydrates. But your body can also make glucose by converting protein and fats. It uses a process that is called gluconeogenesis to do this. And then within the body, some of your glucose is stored and released in the liver. And the body is designed to maintain your blood glucose levels within certain ranges that make the glucose available to your cells when they need it. And to do this, it really relies on a hormone called insulin. When your cells need to take in glucose, the body releases insulin, and that helps your cells take the glucose from the bloodstream into the cells. So what can happen is sometimes people either don't have enough insulin in their body. There's a part of the body that produces insulin, actually, naturally. There are special cells embedded within the pancreas that produce insulin. So sometimes those cells are damaged or not working well. They're not producing enough insulin. Or sometimes your body's cells stop responding to the insulin as easily as they used to. So if for whatever reason there's not enough insulin or it's not working well enough, then your cells can't take in that glucose. And the result is usually that your blood glucose level will go up. You will have high blood sugar. This is also known as hyperglycemia. And if it gets high enough or continues long enough, then you might meet the definition of diabetes. So in diabetes, we really assume that we will see a lot of high blood sugar because usually there's some kind of problem with either not having enough insulin or not responding appropriately to the insulin that the body is producing. Now, at this point, sometimes people say, well, wait, I've heard that people with diabetes also have to worry about low blood sugar. What is that about? So let's briefly touch on that. It's true that people with diabetes do get low blood sugar. That is called hypoglycemia. But this is almost always due to the effect of medications that they are taking to lower their blood glucose. So when people are on medications, now there's one type of medication that we often start older adults on that actually just helps cells use insulin, but otherwise doesn't bring down your blood sugar too much. But many other medications can make your blood sugar too low. So it's important to kind of find the sweet spot where the medications work, but they don't work in a way too well. So unfortunately, often it is necessary to use medications that can make blood sugar too low. And that is the reason why when people have diabetes, we're often concerned about the blood sugar. It might be too high, but it also might be too low. And both issues can be concerning. Blood glucose that is too high or too low can cause symptoms or long-term health consequences. So we want to really try to help people keep their blood sugar within what's considered a safe range and an ideal range. So another frequently asked question is, what is the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes? So let me start with type 1 diabetes. In type 1 diabetes, the body lacks enough insulin because the cells in the pancreas that produce insulin end up being damaged by the body's immune system. There's an autoimmune destruction process that happens. If it's going to happen to people, it often happens during childhood or adolescence, sometimes early adulthood, and it can come on like quite quickly and kids can get quite sick when this happens. There is a form of type 1 diabetes that happens to adults after their age 30. It is called latent autoimmune disease, latent autoimmune diabetes in adults, abbreviated LADA. That tends to come on a little slower than it does with kids, but it is a form of type 1 diabetes. And the thing about this is that since the body stops producing enough insulin, it has to be treated with insulin. So that is type 1 diabetes. It's actually not common for older adults. I don't know that I've ever heard of an older adult who actually developed type 1 diabetes after age 50. It's perhaps possible. But in general, among the older adult population, people who have type 1 diabetes are people who have had diabetes since they were quite young, actually, and have just kind of aged into the older adult age range with their diabetes. What's much more common for older adults, if they're going to develop diabetes, is that they develop type 2 diabetes. So in type 2 diabetes, the cells become resistant to insulin, and the body starts to have to produce more and more insulin to get a response from them and get them to take that blood glucose out of the bloodstream and into the cells. Now, there also can be some element of the body not making quite enough insulin, but it's not to the degree that it is in type 1 diabetes. And this problem where the cells become resistant to insulin is often associated with people being overweight or obese, with having cholesterol issues, and with having what we call metabolic dysfunction, which is a whole sort of syndrome where people don't metabolize often their cholesterols and fats very efficiently. They might also have high blood pressure and other signs of inflammation. And usually they're also having difficulty managing their glucose, in part because their cells aren't responding as well to insulin as they used to. This is by far the most common form of diabetes in older adults and actually in adults in general. And we are unfortunately also now seeing teenagers and sometimes even children develop this form of diabetes, often associated with being overweight or heavy as well. So given that, how do we define diabetes and pre-diabetes? So diabetes is defined really by the level of blood sugar you have under certain circumstances. So one is a fasting blood sugar that is equal to or greater than 126 milligrams per deciliter. Or diabetes can also be diagnosed with a different but related blood test, which is called the hemoglobin A1C. This is a really important test to know about. And hemoglobin A1C basically reflects the percentage of your red blood cells that have been glycated by the glucose floating around in the bloodstream. So this is kind of a process where a little bit of the glucose gets attached to the red blood cell. It's normal. Everybody has some glycated hemoglobin. But as you can imagine, the higher your level of blood sugar chronically, the more of your blood cells are going to have these little bits of sugar added on. So if the percentage of your red blood cells that have been glycated is greater than 6.5%, that qualifies as diabetes. So a hemoglobin A1C greater than 6.5% generally means diabetes. Another possible way to diagnose diabetes is if somebody has what's called a random plasma glucose, so they're not fasting. You just happen to check their labs. Maybe they're in the hospital or they came for a non-fasting blood test. If it's over 200, that is generally going to be considered a sign of diabetes, especially if they have had any symptoms. And I will talk about what the symptoms are in just a moment. So those are the criteria for diagnosing diabetes. Now, if we get one of these numbers, what we always want to do is repeat the test and make sure it's real, potentially repeat it on a different day. But those are the diagnostic criteria. Now, what about prediabetes? So prediabetes is a condition where it looks like your blood sugar is higher than what we consider normal, but not yet high enough to meet that cutoff for diabetes. So what are those ranges? Prediabetes can be diagnosed if somebody has a hemoglobin A1C between 5.7 and 6.4%. That would be considered prediabetes. Or technically, it's a fasting glucose of 100 to 125 milligrams per deciliter. Now, this is kind of a spectrum. The closer you are within prediabetes to the upper range of the range for hemoglobin A1C or for fasting glucose, the closer you are to diabetes. So if you go and get a fasting blood test and your fasting glucose is, 102, that technically qualifies as prediabetes, but you're really just like barely over what we consider the normal range. It still might be good to keep an eye on it, to look at what your past numbers are, to see is this a trend that's kind of going in the wrong direction. But I wouldn't panic for a fasting glucose that is, in the low 100s, especially if your hemoglobin A1C is not anywhere close to 5.7%. And then you might be wondering, well, what is normal? So normal is technically considered a hemoglobin A1C of less than 5.7%. However, there are a number of experts who feel that, a hemoglobin of 5.5% or 5.6% should not be considered, it falls within normal range, but it should not be considered optimal. And generally, there is a lot of evidence that suggests that in general, having an overall lower, you don't want it to be too low, but a blood sugar that tends to be not too high and doesn't spike too high is healthier for the cells. Chronically elevated blood sugar does exert a stress on the body, also on brain cells, and it does seem to slow down damage to the body, slow down inflammation, potentially even slow down aging if you're not chronically running a high blood sugar. So the hemoglobin A1C, one thing that's really great about it is it reflects your average blood sugar over the previous 3 months or so. So there are some experts who feel that even though less than 5.7 is normal, they've been sort of asking the question, what is optimal? And that's not really clear, but it's probably closer to about 5 is what I would say. And then it's extremely unusual and probably even a sign of something potentially going wrong for people to have a hemoglobin A1C of, let's say, less than 4.5%. Many experts are suggesting optimal is probably around 5%. So if you're close to that, 5.1, 5.2, I'd say you're doing pretty well. Whereas if you're 5.5, 5.6, even though you're not yet in the range of prediabetes, that could indicate that maybe you should take a look at how you metabolize glucose, your diet. Is it really sort of high in carbs and sugars? And think about that a bit. Normal would also be a fasting blood sugar less than 100. And when we think about blood glucose levels, it's important to know that this is a dynamic number. It changes throughout the day, depending on your food intake, your exercise, your stress levels, even potentially on how much sleep you got the night before. Whereas hemoglobin A1C is not going to change quickly. It reflects basically your average blood sugar over the previous 3 months. So I think that's often a very useful test to get, the hemoglobin A1C. Okay, let's now talk about what are signs and symptoms of type 2 diabetes. So it turns out that there are what I think of as short-term symptoms and then longer-term symptoms. So in the short term, these are symptoms that occur within hours to days when your blood sugar is getting too high. And it's generally going to be caused by a blood sugar of 180 milligrams per deciliter or more. So this is important to know. If somebody has a fasting blood sugar of 150, which, you know, would indicate diabetes, they are generally not going to have symptoms at that range. And then there are sort of, you know, long-term symptoms, which we might also think of as sort of long-term health consequences of having diabetes, of chronically running a sugar that's in this abnormally high range. These are problems that occur after years of having diabetes. So they're not going to happen just because you ran a high blood sugar for a few weeks or even a few months. It usually is going to take several years. And that's because these problems are often related to the high blood sugar creating chronic damage to blood vessels and to nerves. So let's start now with short-term signs and symptoms of type 2 diabetes. So again, having a higher than normal blood glucose level is generally not going to cause symptoms unless the blood glucose gets above the level of about 180 milligrams per deciliter or more. And why is that? That's because your kidneys are actually designed to filter your blood and retain the glucose in your body so you can feed your body. But if there's too much glucose in your bloodstream, you can overwhelm your kidney's capacity to hold that glucose in the bloodstream. And so the kidney can start to leak glucose into the urine. And this is how diabetes was actually originally diagnosed by doctors, is they would taste the urine and taste that it was sweet because there was actually sugar in it. And it was called diabetes mellitus. And mellitus sort of means sweet, related to honey. So once your blood glucose gets above the range of about 180 to 200, can vary a little bit on the person, the kidneys will start leaking glucose into the urine. The higher your blood sugar, the more they're going to leak glucose into your urine. And when you are leaking glucose into your urine, that actually causes you to pee more. Again, the higher your blood sugar level, the more will spill into your urine and the more extra urination that is going to cause. Blood sugar, again, in that range of 180 to 200 or higher will start to cause extra urination. This tends to make people thirsty and they can often be dehydrated. And so these are very typical symptoms of diabetes, also of type 1 diabetes, is extra urination, being thirsty, and getting dehydrated. Other common symptoms include weight loss and also blurry vision. And that is, again, because when the glucose levels are too high, it can make changes, you know, basically osmotically to certain fluid spaces in the body, including in the eye, and that can cause blurry vision. Then people can also develop even more serious symptoms if their blood sugar is even higher. Now, for type 2 diabetics, they usually need their blood sugar to get like really quite high, like in the range of 500 or 600 or more, to develop these very serious symptoms. But it can happen, and the symptoms there might include nausea, lethargy, confusion, fast heart rate, and actually if they stay at a very high blood sugar level and are very sick like this for a while, it can actually cause coma and even potentially death. So those are the signs and symptoms of type 2 diabetes. And then there are kind of the long-term signs and symptoms, what I think of as long-term health consequences, but I mention them here because people have sometimes asked me about it. They think these are symptoms of diabetes and they're really more consequences is what I would say. But what might happen if you have type 2 diabetes for a while? Well, over years, even having what we might call mild hyperglycemia, meaning, you know, let's say a blood sugar that's often in like the mid 100s or upper 100s, over years and years, this does cause inflammation in your blood vessels and your nerves. And so it can cause problems that we associate with diabetes. These include problems such as eye problems. It's called diabetic retinopathy, where the retinas get affected in a certain way and it can impair vision, potentially even cause people to go blind. People with diabetes are also prone to get kidney disease because the elevated blood sugar puts a lot of strain on the kidneys. They can also get nerve dysfunction. They can get peripheral neuropathy from diabetes or autonomic dysfunction where they might have difficulty regulating their rest and digest system or their heart rate. Again, this usually happens after years and years of having diabetes, not within the first weeks or months. People with diabetes who've had diabetes for a long time can also be prone to getting foot wounds. they can, first of all, injure themselves and not feel it as much because they've lost some nerve feeling in their feet. And also the diabetes can interfere with the wound healing. And so they can get sores and ulcers. In some cases, people can even end up with amputations related to their diabetes. And then diabetes also increases your risk of cardiovascular disease, of heart attacks, of strokes. And it can also impact the health of your very small blood vessels in your brain and cause or worsen cerebral small vessel disease, which is associated with vascular cognitive impairment and eventually even vascular dementia. So these are the problems that happen when people's blood sugar is too high for a long time. But this is a spectrum. So generally, the higher the blood sugar for longer, the more health impacts from diabetes. And so this is why when people have diabetes, we try to help them control their blood sugar, because when their blood sugar is mostly controlled, these long-term consequences happen very late after having diabetes a very, very long time, or maybe they won't even happen at all. So let's now talk about how diabetes is diagnosed, especially in older adults. So especially when it comes to older adults, most diabetes is diagnosed in people who have no symptoms. And that's because it's diagnosed because we notice that their blood sugar is abnormally high on routine labs. So if we check their blood glucose as part of, say, a Chem7, a basic metabolic panel. And if you want to learn more about common labs, I have an episode just about that. So if the blood glucose or the hemoglobin A1C is elevated, often it's a good idea to confirm it with a repeat test. And then some people also are diagnosed because this is noticed on a screening exam. And it turns out that expert guidelines do currently recommend screening adults, especially adults ages 35 to 70, for prediabetes and diabetes, especially if they are overweight or obese. Currently, the American Diabetes Association recommends screening all adults. And then the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, last time they evaluated this a few years ago, felt that especially people who are overweight or obese should be screened. Now, if you end up having a high blood sugar on a test, it's not a slam dunk that it's diabetes. And that is because there are a few conditions and medications that can raise blood glucose. So before we definitively diagnose it, we always want to be checking and making sure that it's not a temporary rise in blood glucose due to certain medications or certain illness states. And then let's say you have a high blood sugar, it's been kind of confirmed, and it looks like you have diabetes. What happens after that? So there are some additional steps that health providers generally should take. So generally, this should include checking for long-term consequences of diabetes, because sometimes we're not sure how long the person has been running a high blood sugar, right? So normally they would do some additional tests to check and see, well, how is this person's kidney function? Has it been affected? How are their eyes? Have it been affected? How are their nerves? How is their cardiovascular state? Both because we want to sort of be aware if there are problems there, and also monitor the progression of these potential long-term consequences. Another very important thing for providers to do with people who have been just diagnosed with diabetes is to evaluate their current diet and exercise habits. Because, as I'll explain, addressing diet and exercise is often a really important part of managing diabetes. It's also highly recommended that people be referred for more diabetes education. The health provider, doctor, or nurse practitioner who sees you for your regular visits may or may not be the best person to do this. Doctors in particular tend to be very busy, and so often it can be good to refer somebody with diabetes to a class or to a health educator where they can learn a lot of basics about how to manage it and how to take care of themselves. And then the health providers should work with you on an initial plan for how they're going to monitor your glucose and how they're going to monitor the treatment plan. And so part of that, and it's really important, is to discuss what is your current hemoglobin A1C and what goal is appropriate for you. Because if your hemoglobin A1C is, let's say, 6.6, you barely meet the cutoff for diabetes. Whereas if it's 8.5, your sugar has been pretty high these past few months, and maybe more needs to be done to bring it down. So it's really important to ask, what exactly is my hemoglobin A1C? And then where are we trying to get it to? And let's talk a little bit more about that. So what should the goal be? I am a huge fan of health providers setting a goal and working with their patients to communicate that goal and maybe agree on it, because your perspective as the patient might have a lot to do with the goal as well. So what people sometimes don't realize, especially when it comes to older adults, is that there is no one-size-fits-all goal for everybody. And in fact, it is important to set the goal in light of an older person's health state and life expectancy. So what does this mean? What this means is that guidelines right now recommend that if an older person is, they say healthy, I put healthy-ish, but if they're healthy, healthy-ish, they should aim for a hemoglobin A1C less than 7.5%. And I will talk in a moment more about what I consider healthy and healthy-ish. If they're in intermediate health, so for example, a life expectancy less than 10 years, then trying to get the A1C to be 8% or less would be reasonable. And then if they are in poor health, so for instance, somebody who might be very frail, who's been hospitalized quite a lot lately, then it might be appropriate to aim for 8.5% or less. So what does this mean? Basically, it means that if people are very unwell, we want to be less aggressive about trying to very tightly control their blood sugar and get it to be as low as possible. And I'm going to explain a little bit more why we take that approach. Whereas if they are healthy, then we can aim for less than 7.5. Now, I wrote healthy-ish, and that's because there are lots of older adults who have chronic health conditions, right? They might have high blood pressure. They might have heart disease. They might already have kidney disease. I mean, there are a number of chronic conditions that older adults can have. And if they're not often getting hospitalized, if they're still living independently, they might be pretty strong. We might still be expecting that with good care, they're likely to live more than 10 years. And so then it might be totally appropriate to aim for a hemoglobin A1C of 7.5 or less, even though they do have these chronic conditions. Now, one thing that sometimes comes up for me in my work is that sometimes I notice an older person who is on medications to lower blood glucose and their A1C is less than 7. This is often a little bit of a red flag for me, because less than 7 is pretty tight control. And so if they're on meds and they're less than 7, the question is, do they need quite as much medication? And that's because unless the medication they're on is metformin, which is a specific kind of medication that can't make you go too low, people who are on medicine and have an A1C less than 7%, especially if they're older, are at greater risk of having hypoglycemia episodes, episodes where the glucose will be too low. And those can potentially be dangerous for them. So that is something that I personally consider a little flag that maybe we need to reconsider, the diabetes treatment. So let me now speak a little bit more about why we have often a higher hemoglobin A1C goal in older adults. So again, the reason is that treating diabetes with medications other than metformin can easily cause low blood sugar, hypoglycemia. And this is dangerous. This can cause confusion or falls in the short term. And frequent hypoglycemia has been linked to cognitive decline and also worse cardiovascular disease. It's basically a stressor on the body. It increases inflammation, and that's not good for your brain cells, and it's not good for your blood vessel walls either. Another reason why we often have a higher A1C goal is that trying to maintain tight blood glucose control can be burdensome for older adults, especially if they already have many chronic conditions to manage, or if maybe they're having difficulty with their memory or thinking. Lastly, it's important to remember that modestly elevated blood sugar, so for instance, in the range of 126 to 180, generally doesn't cause symptoms, doesn't even cause dehydration or extra urination, and it can take years for those longer-term effects to manifest. So especially if a person gets diagnosed with diabetes when they're already in, you know, their 70s, we might feel like it's not necessary to have super tight control. So given that, let me now share what are our diabetes treatment priorities in geriatrics. So generally, especially since we tend to work with adults who are older and frailer, we really prioritize short-term safety and quality of life. So we try to avoid blood sugar being high enough to trigger that glucose in the urine. So we try to avoid blood sugar that's above 180 because we don't want extra urination, thirst, to dehydration. And then we really are careful about monitoring and trying to avoid hypoglycemia, blood sugar less than 70, to reduce fall risk and to protect cognition and cardiovascular health. And we also try to work closely and collaboratively with patients and families to set an appropriate hemoglobin A1C goal and develop a manageable treatment plan. So let's now talk about treatment. So I'm not going to go into depth about all the different medication options because there are a lot of them right now, including some exciting newer choices, right? Like Ozempic. But there are some basic treatment principles that I want to cover right now. So first of all, treatment should always include lifestyle measures, such as increasing exercise and activity levels. And in fact, for some people who have an A1C that is, 6.5, 6.6, not too high, just increasing their exercise and activity, maybe changing their diet and losing a little weight can be enough to take them out of the range of diabetes and put them back in the pre-diabetes range. So we want to think about increasing exercise and activity. We want to encourage weight loss if possible. And then we definitely want to try some dietary counseling, have somebody work closely with the older person to sort of review what they're eating and see how they can modify their diet so that's a little bit better for their blood sugar control. Different people are going to respond to different diets. For many people, a low-carb Mediterranean diet can be a very good choice, but it's really going to depend on the person. And if you want to learn more about diet and aging, I have a video about that as well. It's always going to be a good idea to minimize added sugars and ultra-processed foods. And then if the lifestyle measures are insufficient to reach the goal, or if people start off with an A1C that's like fairly high, like already over 7.5, then we want to think about medication. And for many older adults, not all, but many, metformin is a really good first choice. So this is a very old medication. It's generic. It's inexpensive. It has a very long track record. And the way it works is instead of directly lowering blood glucose, it just helps your cells do a better job of taking in the glucose that is there and of using the insulin. That's actually really how it works. It helps your cells respond better to your body's insulin levels. And this means that unlike almost all other diabetes medications, it almost never makes an older person go too low. So it is relatively safe and it's a great choice. It also has a good track record of actually improving health outcomes overall. It's being tested right now as an anti-aging drug, actually. So it may have benefits that we still don't entirely understand. So metformin is often a good choice. And so if you're diagnosed with diabetes and they say you need medication, but they don't offer you metformin, I would definitely recommend asking some questions so you can learn more about why they think metformin is not a good choice for you, because you would be sort of in a minority often. And then after people start metformin, they still might need more medication to control their diabetes. And also some of the newer diabetes medications can have other benefits for people who already have signs of some kidney damage or for people who have heart failure. So there can be some other medications that might be recommended as well. And then what's common is to monitor the hemoglobin A1C quarterly every 3 months until you've developed a stable treatment plan. Another potential way to monitor blood sugar is to try a continuous blood glucose monitor. So this is basically a special patch. It's got a little filament. When you apply it, there's a little needle that briefly sticks the person to put the filament in. And afterwards, that filament is in the subcutaneous tissue, often on the back of the arm. And it continuously monitors your blood sugar and will transmit the readings usually to a smartphone. This can be really helpful if people are kind of testing out different diets or wanting to better understand how they respond to certain foods, or even to see how their glucose changes as a function of their exercise or how they slept. So that's another option. And Medicare now covers continuous glucose monitors. So that's an option to consider as well. So those are the fundamentals of initial treatment of type 2 diabetes for most older adults. Let me now say a few words about what about prediabetes? How would we treat prediabetes? So for prediabetes, we really want to focus on lifestyle measures. So again, increasing exercise is one of the best things you can do because it's not only good for your blood sugar, but it has just a million other benefits. And if you want to know more about exercise, I have a video about that as well. You want to lose weight if possible. You want to revise your diet. Take a good look. Again, a low carb Mediterranean diet is often a good choice for many people, but may not be always the best choice for everyone, but worth considering. And then minimizing added sugars and ultra processed food is also always a good idea. And then occasionally people with prediabetes are treated with medication as well. So now we have the GLP-1 drugs such as Ozempic. And so especially if a person is obese, they are effective in helping people lose weight, and that can really improve prediabetes and potentially even get people down to normal blood sugar levels. And then very occasionally, a health provider might try metformin as well for somebody who just has prediabetes. And then I have been talking about treating prediabetes, but I also want to point out that in many cases, it might be reasonable to not treat prediabetes. And this is especially true in people who are frail or in poor health. And the reason for this is that it sometimes is a sensible choice to not burden an older person with dietary changes, because often when people have prediabetes, it can take years for them to progress to diabetes. So if their health is not good or they have a lot of other things going on, we might choose to focus on other ways to improve their health or to help them optimize their quality of life. So just something to keep in mind, which is that we can treat prediabetes, but in some cases, it might be reasonable to just lightly monitor it and focus our medical attentions elsewhere. So given all that, what should you do if you're concerned about diabetes for yourself or another older loved one? So my recommendations would be, first of all, ask about getting your hemoglobin A1C checked, and then compare it to past values if you have them. It's often really helpful to see what a person's trend has been. If you are in or close to the pre-diabetic level, which again is a hemoglobin A1C of 5.7 to 6.4%, I would suggest increasing your exercise and trying to improve your diet, losing weight if you can. If you are diagnosed with diabetes, you'll want to work with your health providers on a treatment plan. Remember to always include lifestyle measures. And then if you are on medications other than metformin, I recommend being careful about hypoglycemia, monitoring for that. And I recommend discussing your hemoglobin A1C goal with your health provider, understanding where are they trying to get you to and why, you know, which category are you in. For many older adults, a hemoglobin A1C of 7 to 7.5 is reasonable. That's reasonable if they're fairly healthy, and especially if they're expected to live more than 10 years. But for people who have a lot of illness going on, frailty, maybe have been hospitalized a lot, or, you know, maybe are in their late 80s or 90s, a higher goal for the hemoglobin A1C might be appropriate as well. And so that's what I have for now. And again, in an upcoming video, I am planning to cover in more depth some of the medications that are available for diabetes and some other diabetes treatments, because I know that lots of people are wondering about that these days, especially given the newer medications that we have today. And with that, thank you so much for watching. And if you found this video podcast helpful, if you're here on YouTube, please go ahead and subscribe. It does help more people find the channel. If you've been listening to the audio version on the podcast feed, please come and take a look at the video if you get a chance. You'll see my key points being displayed on the screen. And so thank you once again, and I look forward to seeing you all again on a future episode of the Better Health While Aging video podcast.